This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 96. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How are you doing this week, Rob?
I'm good. I just took 4 days off for Labor Day weekend. So, of course, instead of actually taking 4 days off, I got this bug in my ear over the weekend and rewrote my churn, not algorithm, but my report. I have this one-page dashboard I use in Hittail and has all these numbers, lifetime value, and I've talked about it before. But what was bothering me is that when I got a big spike in new customers, my churn 30 days later would spike way up. And the reason is with typical SaaS businesses, any type of recurring business, you have the highest churn in your first 30, 60, 90 days, and then it settles down after that. And so if you have an imbalance, you know, people who are in their first 30 days, if you have a ton of them, then your overall churn is really not a good measure because you need to break it down. And so I was like, no problem. I'm just going to split that out. It's the weekend. You know, I had a Corona with a lime in it, and I'm sitting there writing a little bit of some SQL queries. And 5 hours later, it kept not working the way I wanted. Now, granted, my data model is not the most elegant and normalized data model. I inherited it from the previous owners. So there were some challenges as well as some dirty data. I have to kind of code around in the SQL statements. Don't include it if that string field includes this underscore. I mean, just crazy stuff like that. But once it all got done, now I'm very happy that I spent almost an entire day over Labor Day weekend to split out my churn into 30, 60, 90 days and beyond. All right. So how about you? What have you been up to?
I spent the last week or so working pretty hard on AutoShark, and I've churned out more than 5,000 lines of code over the past week and a half or so. A lot of it was of the, I'll say, copy and reformat type of code. So basically, I had a component that I had built, and then I needed to build another component, but I also needed to reuse, or I wanted them to share the same kind of web services in the back end. So essentially, what I did was I wrote a generic version of the component code and all the classes that go along with it. And so essentially I had to refactor a lot of the code in order to make it generic enough that I could use it again for other components that I have that are coming down the line a little bit later. So it, you know, most of it, as I said, was copy paste, but I had to tweak a lot of it and make sure that the logic still worked. And that took a long time to get done, but I'm really happy with how it all came out. And as of yesterday, I've had the new agent installed on a couple of servers and it's been running and haven't seen any problems so far.
Well, good. Is it true that as of today, we are 6 days away from the Audit Shark early access?
Yes, it is true.
And so when this goes live, it will actually be the day after. So yeah, it's your early access is on September 10th. You looking to hit that?
I think so. I'm looking at my list of things that still need to be done on my end for the early access. And it says that I've got 36 and a half hours worth of work left. I went through everything that I have in Fogbugs and assigned a time estimate to it. And I was pretty conservative for most of my time estimates. So I think that it seems reasonable. And the 36 and a half hours from today would realistically leaves me about a day short. But as I said, I was conservative with those times. And I think that some of them will, you know, just take a little bit less time than I've estimated. I fully plan on spending some additional time probably this weekend to make sure that everything gets done. I won't call it a concern, but the one thing that I'm not terribly happy about is that I know that some of the content is not going to be done. So I'm not going to be able to launch it with the policies the way that I want them to be from the server. So there's not going to be enough content that people are auditing for on day one. But that's also something that's going to take time anyway. I mean, it's not like I can just launch on day one. And like if I was doing a vulnerability scanner, I couldn't launch on day one and say, okay, well, I've got, you know, 3 million vulnerabilities that I'm scanning for. It just doesn't really work that way.
I think that's why they call it early access.
Yeah.
Yep. So August was a good month for Hittail. I was actually worried because July was the best month ever, but there was that $1,000 article order, remember? And I was, you know, concerned that I was actually going to decrease, you know, have less revenue, but I wound up making it past that and another several hundred bucks. So I made it to another milestone, and some things I'm doing in terms of marketing are not working at all. But the ones that are working quite well. And so it's driving a lot of new trials, you know, continues to grow it. So it's feeling good to be hitting on a few of the cylinders that I'm trying.
Well, that's really good to hear, you know, and that's part of why I'm working on Audit Shark and kind of repositioned it as more of a SaaS application than anything else. And I kind of made that decision a long time ago. But in talking to some of the web hosts these past couple of weeks, I found that they're more than willing to pay for, you know, a product like Audit Shark on a subscription basis. And the price points that I've kind of talked to them about, they don't really seem to blink at them. They're just like, oh, yeah, a couple $1,000 a month. That's no big deal, whatever.
Yeah, I would expect that wouldn't be a huge sticking point for them. Mm-hmm. Speaking of a couple $1,000 a month, do you have a billing mechanism in place if people sign up?
No, and actually, I have a contractor who's working on that right now. And that's one of those things where, why are you giving me crap over this? Aren't you the one who like waited until 3 days before you had to bill somebody that you
indeed
put it
I
in
did.
Place?
Well, yeah. But the funny part is you put it in the outline, and I'm like, wow, he's working on it already. This is way ahead of schedule, you know, in my mind. Early access, you're like at least a minimum of 30 days away from billing somebody. Well, you have a 30-day trial? Is that what it is?
Yeah. The thing is, this is just to get the thing started for them to sign up. It isn't the actual billing code itself. It's just, as part of the initial registration for customers, here, enter your billing information. I'll save in a token in the back end so that I can bill you later. I'm not actually building the billing code yet.
Right. And that makes sense. And that code, actually, it's not as simple as it sounds, because they do the cool JavaScript thing where you don't need PCI compliance. But as a result, it's a new, unique experience that no one else does. So you really do have to dig in and understand what they're doing in order to implement it.
Yeah, I really don't, because this contractor has already done it, and he did it for AltirisTraining.com, which is why he's doing it for this product as well.
Awesome.
Definitely. Not only code reuse, but contractor reuse.
That's the best way, man. I mean, that's something every time I talk to someone about outsourcing, I say, if you find a good, whatever, developer, virtual assistant, designer, any of these things, you keep them around. I have people who've worked for me for 5 years, you know, and they may be part-time, they may be hourly, they may be halfway across the world, but it's like all the knowledge that they have from my various businesses helps me moving forward, because I don't have to redefine everything. So valuable to train someone like you're doing on one or even multiple of your apps, because you're going to tend to use the same billing systems, you're going to tend to have the same approaches, and it's great if someone's up to speed. It's similar to having an employee who's just around and kind of understands the legacy of how you do things.
Mm-hmm. The one thing I've found is a challenge in working with some of these guys, though, is that when I go to reply to like some of their questions and stuff, that the Google... So when you reply to somebody, the height of the box that you're typing your message into, it's only like 240 or 260 pixels tall. So it makes it difficult to see what somebody else has said in line with what you're typing, which is kind of a pain in the neck. So I went out to search for some Chrome extensions that would actually allow you to expand the size of that. And I tweeted about it, and somebody said, oh, well, in Firefox, you can just drag it and, you know, make it whatever size you want. And I'm like, yeah, stupid Firefox. So, but I went out and I found these extensions and I went to install them, and you can't install them anymore. You have to go to Google Chrome's web store in order to install them.
Google is doing crazy stuff. I mean, I don't know why they're doing that. Maybe it's a security thing, but it just seems like they're making things hard on a lot of people with a lot of the choices they're making with their tools now.
Yeah, I read up on it. There is a way to do it. You can basically drag it onto the extension. Like, if you have to download the extension onto your hard drive, and then you have to drag it from there onto the extensions page in your web browser, and then you can install it. But it's a manual effort, and they said that they've done that intentionally to help increase the security of the web browser, which is fine, but... it is in no way, shape, or form obvious that that's what you have to do in order to get it installed. They just pop up this little thing that says, oh, you can't install this. You have to go download it from the web store instead.
Well, and the trippy thing with Chrome is on most of the websites I visit, if there's a little text area, it has the draggable thing in the bottom right, but it doesn't have that when I'm looking at Gmail in Chrome. I wonder if it's in the Google Labs. Did you see if there's just one, an enabler? I guess a listener will let us know if that's the case.
Yeah, I just remember searching for a quick fix to it, and the Chrome extension was one of the first things that came up. And I'm like, oh, that's a very quick fix. It's simple. And I went to do it, and it just didn't work. So I just thought I'd mention that it's, you know, they changed their security model on Chrome.
Well, this is one of, like I said, so many things they're doing lately that I'm just, it's like making it harder on people in general. I mean, they did the Penguin update, which made it harder on SEOs, whatever, you know, that's fine. Although they did, you know, kind of hose me with the badges. They went back, stuff that used to work doesn't work. They have shut down their API. They had a search API that all the rank trackers used to use. You know, so if you were trying to track your rank of keywords, you could hit the search API, get the results back, and search for your URL. And my URL ranks this high for this keyword. They shut that down. They like deprecated it. So now any rank tracker you use is scraping, screen scraping Google. And they have to have these banks of servers with multiple external IPs or Google will shut them down. They have to make it look like they're a bunch of different computers.
Funny that you mentioned that because my web server in Rackspace is hosted on a subnet where they're doing that. And whenever I try to go to Google and search when I'm on that server, if I need to get something, Google pops up this thing that says, please confirm you're a real person because we received too many searches from this IP subnet.
Bingo. So they're doing that. You know they have a reason, but it stinks. It makes it crappier for end users or people who used to use the Google API. I actually had an app that used it at one point. Luckily, it's not in production anymore. And then they're taking keywords out of the searches. You know, if you look in your Google Analytics account, I mean, this is about a year old now, but anytime anyone's logged into Google, then when they do a search and they find your website for a particular keyword, Google won't tell you what that term is anymore. It just says not provided, which is that stinks. Like I have a lot of websites that where that is very important information for me to know and to know who's, how they're getting there and you know what terms are converting and stuff. The trick is if you pay for clicks, if you pay for AdWords clicks, they will show you the keywords even if someone's logged into Google.
Is that what it is?
Yes. Isn't that crazy? So that it's really a trip to watch these companies. You know the recent hubbub with Twitter and what they've done with their API and they're really hurting developers. And then you look at Facebook and the changes, some of the changes they're making with privacy and all that stuff. You look at Google, as these companies are like clawing, they've gone public or, you know, Twitter hasn't yet, but, you know, they're on the road to it. And they're like clawing for this revenue. They really start to do stuff that just, it isn't, I don't know that it's necessarily in line with the don't be evil thing anymore.
Well, they canned that whole statement a while back. They reworked some of their pages and somebody noticed that the don't be evil slogan had basically been removed.
Yeah, I mean, so I'm not saying, certainly not a conspiracy theory, right? Oh, yes, shocker. Companies are going to, you know, if you're not paying for a service, then you are the product, right? If you're not paying for it, Facebook, they obviously are marketing you. Same thing with Twitter and Google. None of this is shocking. I'm not saying Google is the worst thing on the planet. I use a lot of their tools and like it, but it is a bummer when it impacts our usability, our ability to basically support our businesses, you know, as we use their tools. And I don't know. I hope things turn around, but I don't necessarily see that in the future.
Well, I think that they're just going to, you know, continue to do whatever. I mean, I don't expect them to work any different than any other company, and they're going to do whatever's best for them. And,
right. You
know, that's going to fit in line with their don't be evil. And the face of that is going to be, well, if it's bad for us, we can't do it. And, you know, if it's evil for us, it must be evil for the world. So if you're doing something that, you know, negatively affects us, then we're going to shut you down because it hurts us, which ultimately turns around and hurts everybody else, which isn't necessarily true. But, you know, that's the line of thinking that I feel like they're following. There are certain things that they're doing that I just kind of shake my head.
Right. I mean, even the not showing the keywords when someone's logged in, that is absolutely impacting retail. Like I'm able to provide my service is able to provide less value to people because I have less information on how people are finding your website. So I can't offer as many suggestions.
So what are we doing today?
We are talking to Robert Graham about cold calling, and not cold calling in the traditional sense. He's done a lot of customer development and vetting business ideas using cold calling, and he's a software developer. I don't know, not someone who you would think that would really be drawn to this. So today, Mike and I are going to be having a chat with Robert Graham, native of Austin, Texas. How are things today, Robert?
Going pretty well. How are you guys doing?
Doing all right. Robert Graham is a software developer. He's actually a longtime member of the Micropreneur Academy. He's gone to both microconfs and he's just, you know, a friend of the show. Robert has kind of carved out this niche, probably by mistake, I think he told me once. He's gotten really good at cold calling and he's a believer in the customer development, lean startup approach. And so he started doing cold calling for some of the ideas he had. And he wound up writing an ebook on it. The ebook's selling well. And, you know, I'm just fascinated by this concept because it's never something I've done to great scale. And Robert's done it so many times that he's, you know, become kind of a startup expert on it. So welcome to the show, Robert. And if you could kind of just give us a little more background about kind of who you are, you know, what you do and how you fell into cold calling.
Okay, sure. I kind of came to this totally by accident, like you said. Been a software developer forever. You know, like in eighth grade, I was writing basic on my calculator to solve quadratic equations for me in class. I guess I got into a niche, you know, from my background. I grew up in Southeast Texas, hunting and fishing. My dad and pretty much all of the red-blooded males that I grew up with all did. You know, I knew a bunch of guys that had land or were big hunters. And so I jumped in at some point whenever I made some of my first products to wildlife management. And it turned out that they were not as online as I had hoped. And so it was kind of one of my really last-ditch ways to connect. I tried cold calling and really kind of stumbled into some success after calling a lot of people with phone calls that maybe I got to talk to someone, but it wasn't taking me anywhere. And other ones where I know in the first couple of calls, if I got a voicemail prompt, I was happy, like it was a success. So I didn't start in a place where I was very good at this or even excited to try. But eventually, after a little bit of success, it went the other direction for me.
Right. And have you used cold calling both to vet ideas, like in the customer development sense, and as well as to make sales? Or what have you used them for in the past?
Yeah, so this gets a little into the semantics of what you mean by cold calling. I don't know if I've ever like sold something directly over the phone where the person I'm calling I've never spoken with before, but I've definitely used cold calling to start relationships that ended in sales.
Got it. Okay. As well as to vet product ideas? Is that right? To figure out if someone would be willing to pay for a product and you're trying to figure out if you're going to build it at all?
Yeah. I mean, that's probably the number one thing I've done with cold calling.
Got it.
And I think the two things are tied up together. If I were kind of starting over today, how I would approach it.
Right. Now, Mike, you've also done cold calling. What capacity did you do it in?
It was for my own company. It was for Moon River Consulting. And it was back in probably end of 2007, early 2008, when I had started trying to scale up the company. And essentially, it was trying to generate leads for, you know, some of the products that we were selling and doing consulting on. They were primarily Alteris and Symantec products. And essentially, what we were doing is we would get this list of, they called them unqualified or semi-qualified leads from Symantec. So whenever you download, whenever an enterprise customer downloads something from them, you give them your email address and they will add it into their database and try and, you know, match it up with any phone numbers or names that they might have. And then they'll take those leads that if they don't think that they're worth their own sales reps' time to follow up on, they'll basically divvy them up and send them out to their partners. So what I was doing was going through this list of leads and trying to talk to people to figure out what it is that they were really looking for and whether or not there was anything that we could help them with.
Got it. Okay, so you really were doing then outbound cold calling for sales.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's cool. So that's good to know. So it sounds like we have a variety of experience here. Robert, you wrote an ebook on this. It said, what's the URL?
It's www.coldcallingbook.net.
Okay, so talk to me about how cold calling and cold emailing maybe complement things like content creation, list building, and traffic generation. Like, why would someone do cold calling in addition to those other things?
Right. So I think the biggest answer is because they can be extremely complementary. One of the things that you need to do as part of any content creation strategy is have, you know, good sources for that content and good places to continue getting new ideas. And I think whether part of a, say, interview series with some of your customers or your potential customers, where you could highlight themselves, their facilities, how they do business, best practices, you could invent awards that you give out and do all kinds of different things where you have, you know, ready-made content for the web. I know the award idea I kind of stole from Rand Fishkin, who talked a lot about it. And he said there's one, you know, like Seattle Startups Top 100 or something page that, you know, is just someone's complete invention. And it doesn't even matter how the rankings get generated or why, but that everyone that he knows in the scene visits the page because they want to see the rank. And I think that's true of, you know, everybody's experience with list posts and rankings across all kinds of different things. So it's a good way to have content to put out there. It's a good way to, you know, have goodwill with your customers and also start relationships with new people. And that means a lot of different things. But cold calling, if you're mostly online or you're mostly, you know, in magazines or wherever your main channels are, if you're going to cold call, you can really tap into, you know, networks that you're not a part of. And even a small foothold in a new network can have an exponential effect once you, you know, make some people there really happy.
I see. So you're saying you use the cold calling to build a relationship to get into a network that you otherwise wouldn't be able to.
Right.
I'm curious, Mike, I'm curious to hear your sense of, like, back in the day when you were doing cold calling, why were you doing cold calling instead of other types of, whether it was like online marketing or other approaches?
I started doing cold calling more in part because it was kind of forced on me. The previous relationship that had been in place between Altiris and Symantec and their partners was that, you know, you would work very hand in hand with the sales reps, and then Symantec started pulling in a lot of the leads that they were getting and started bringing in partners a lot less, and basically said, well, instead of us giving you leads, you're going to have to find your own. And they ended up torpedoing most of their partner network at one point because of that. And in about a year, they shifted their strategy and kind of came back around on it. But by then, they'd already killed about half their partners in that particular space. So for me, it was more of a, I'll say, a forced direction than something I said, oh, well, this seems like a great idea. And one of the things that I found was that when you actually get in and you start talking to somebody, especially when it comes to enterprise sales, they expect you to be there, and they expect to be able to put a face with a name is really what it comes down to. And doing any sort of inbound marketing efforts, those tend to yield a lot less because at the enterprise scale, these customers are used to having sales reps kind of walk in the door and introduce themselves and say, here, this is what I've got for you, and this is how it can solve problems X, Y, and Z.
Right. Okay. We're really talking about two different kinds of cold calling here. Mike has done mostly entirely outbound sales cold calling, what we would traditionally think of as that kind of stuff. And Robert has done mostly customer development cold calling, which is calling people to figure out if they would buy an app before he builds it. And then often, like he said, that does turn into a relationship later on that he can then go make the sale because the person has probably followed his development for several months while he got the product going. So we're going to keep those two things going. So I think my first question is, as someone who is obviously much more of an online marketer, and I bet there are a lot of folks listening to the podcast who feel the same way, there is this aversion to cold calling. In your book, Robert, you say it's like how to get over the fear. So use the word fear or, you know, lack of desire to do it. What are some strategies or some thoughts on how you've done it, how you would recommend people do it? And then, Mike, I think we'll toss it over to you when he's done.
You're specifically asking about overcoming fear?
Yeah.
Yeah, so overcoming fear is a big thing for a lot of people with cold calling. And I kind of look at it a little bit in the rearview mirror, which I think is both really good for giving advice and really bad for giving advice. Sometimes hindsight's 20/20, but it's not quite right. I think the really bad cliched answer that everyone will give is just do it and it'll get better. You know, practice makes perfect. A better answer is, you need to figure out exactly what it is about cold calling that bothers you. You know, are you unconvinced that it will help your business? Are you scared of rejection? Are you scared of, you know, talking to people you don't know? Are you scared of humiliation? Are you scared your product isn't good enough? You need to really think about, you know, and isolate those factors and then kind of come up with things that you can do, whether it's role playing with friends, calling old friends out of the blue, you know, maybe some of the pickup artist techniques that you see where people, you know, try to get rejected in the mall by people they don't know. There are lots of different things that you can try to experiment with to get over some of those fears. And then, I mean, eventually you just have to take the final step and make some calls and know that, you know, the worst case on a bad cold call is that you get rejected, maybe someone yells at you. Honestly, in all the cold calls I've done, the worst I can say that I've had is someone say that they weren't interested in a less than friendly way.
Right, which is not that bad. And so when you were vetting, say, I know you ran a kind of a tracking service for white-tailed deer, and did you make calls before that to find out if people were interested, or did you build it first and then call?
So there were two products in that space. And the first one I built before I called anyone, and the second one I built after I had done some customer development. And each of them kind of had varied levels of success. And it's a long story, but that's the answer.
Got it. Okay. And so if someone's listening to this and they're thinking, you know, I don't have a white-tailed deer startup. I have a startup where people are online. You know, it's an analytics package or it's something dealing with social media. I know my audience is online and I know that I can do some SEO or pay-per-click or get on Hacker News or TechCrunch or any of these things, build a landing page, get an email address, and then email some people and start some conversations. In your opinion, do you think they should consider cold calling and what do you think the benefits would be over the approach I just mentioned?
I think it does depend a little bit on your market. I think you need to gauge what people's expectations would be and if receiving a cold call for that type of business would be an absolute shock, then you probably don't need to engage in cold calling. But there are a lot of businesses that while they have an online component or they can get, you know, significant online traffic, it's also, you know, a traditional B2B scenario where it's definitely inbounds to make calls to people and see what they would be interested in doing. I know a lot of different things come to mind. I would say, you know, I was in wildlife management. There's a big agricultural industry. I know a couple other people writing software in that space that are making full-time livings, and cold calling is kind of a part of it for them. I would say proposals for designers is another place where it seems like a lot of those companies wouldn't be totally out of bounds to give a call. It may not be the fastest way to scale in every context, but I think it's a great way to jumpstart, and it's a great way to jumpstart sort of new areas that you're not well established.
Right. So Mike, back to you. I mentioned earlier, you know, there's this fear or this aversion to cold calling. You obviously did it. How did you get over that?
It took a while, to be perfectly honest. And I came to the realization, thankfully, it was kind of early on, but it probably took a week or two of calls before I kind of got over it. But it was exactly the fear of calling. And I couldn't quite figure out why it was that I was afraid to call. I finally ended up narrowing it down to the fact that I didn't want to make the mistakes in the calls that I was making because I didn't want to get rejected. And it wasn't so much getting rejected. It was the fear of losing, you know, whatever sale I was trying to pursue. It's like, oh, if I say the wrong thing, this person will hang up on me and, oh, there's a $30,000 sale that I just lost because I said the wrong thing. And that's one of those risks that you're just going to have to take. I mean, and you have to learn what works and what doesn't. So what I ended up doing was I actually invested in a product called ACT. And what I would do is I would take detailed notes about who I was calling, when I was calling them, and when I got through, exactly what I was saying to them. And then I would essentially cross-reference what I was talking to each person about with the other people that I was talking to about that particular topic. I also seemed to find that there were certain times of the day that made it easier to get through to people. So first thing in the morning, at the very end of the day, it was usually good times to call. Sometimes in the middle of the morning, 10 a.m., 11 a.m. wasn't so good. You tend to interrupt people and run into a lot of issues there. It really just took a lot of practice and getting over the fear that, oh, I'm going to lose something by calling this person or I'm not ever going to be able to talk to this person again. And usually, I can't think of anybody who I called and they were just rude up front, but it was definitely a learning experience throughout the course of making all those calls.
Yeah, sure. So what was your worst? Was your worst response also something like, I'm not interested in a rude voice?
Yeah, I'd say that was probably, I mean, I never got profanity. At least, I mean, I've gotten profanity from people in in-person consulting before, but never
nice.
Over the phone.
Nice.
Yeah, I never got anybody who just swore at me and just screamed, don't ever call me again. It was just,
right.
You know, look, I'm really not interested.
Yeah, because it's different than the cold calling. I think that we as consumers think of are the people who are calling at like 6 p.m., you know, right at dinner time, and they're trying to sell you long distance.
Yeah.
At least targeted, you know, both what Robert has done and what you've done. It's at least like, I work for this company, we provide this service. That's a cost of doing business. Like that's, I mean, I've been in that position where I get inbound calls. I was managing teams at development houses and people want to sell you tools or they want to sell you services or whatever. And yeah, I was always respectful and I feel like most people are going to be. So it really does. I do hear that from both of you that it's kind of like, it almost sounds like, yeah, you know, this fear to doing the cold calling is probably overrated. You're not likely to get people yelling at you. It might also be the time thing, you know, like Robert said, maybe people don't think it's going to work or don't think it's going to be time well spent. Now, you know, Mike, you did cold calling to make sales. Did you find it was a reasonable use of your time? Or, I mean, did it generate sales or did you eventually abandon it and just kind of say, this isn't working right now in this niche?
No, I did. I actually landed one of my largest sales by calling people. One of them was a $169,000 sale. So it was not small by any means. I mean, it was definitely worth it in that regard. But the problem was that, and it sort of came back to the fear of calling people. I was afraid to make mistakes. And part of it was, that was one of the early experiences that I had with the cold calling, was I made this, you know, really, really great sale that just came out of left field. Nobody, you know, in Symantec or Alteryx expected it. And, you know, it just kind of landed in my lap. And so I was constantly afraid of making mistakes going forward. And, you know, looking back on it now, I realize that, you know, most entrepreneurs who are doing online marketing are doing the exact type of thing that I was doing then, is just in a different mental category. When you drive people to your website, you know, you only expect to convert like, what, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 out of 100. And that's kind of the status quo. That's no big deal. But the same thing, you know, not those exact same numbers, but there's going to be similar ratios of some kind where there's X number of people that you call out of 100 that are not going to respond to what you say. And I think the fear is, for me, it really derived from, okay, well, how many of these calls do I have to make in order before I get to one that is actually going to yield any sort of actionable thing that I can go after?
Right. And do you have a rule of thumb at all in your, based on your experience?
Specifically for what?
For what you're doing, like outbound. It was a cold list to you. You didn't have a relationship with them, but it was at least a targeted list. Yeah. It wasn't very targeted.
No. I learned after the fact that it was much less targeted than I would have thought.
So with that in mind, with that description, do you remember any idea like how many calls you had to make in order to get to the next step?
It really depended on how targeted the person was that I talked to. I was pitching a specific type of product. If they happened to submit an email for a webcast that they may or may not have actually been interested in, they maybe just saw the headline, then it kind of got categorized in a specific way. And they just said, you know, Symantec just said, oh, well, this person is in this bucket, and go ahead and call them and see if they're interested. And a lot of times it just wasn't well-qualified traffic. I very much related to the same type of thing of like getting on the front page of TechCrunch and getting 100,000 people to your website, but how many of those people are targeted and actually interested in what it is you have on your website?
Right. So it was a lot of people walking up at a conference to your booth and saying, I want to enter the iPad competition or the iPad contest to win it. And so they scan your badge and it goes on a list, but
yep,
you don't really want the product. You want the iPad.
Yep.
Yeah. I was going to piggyback on what Mike was saying about the conversion rates and talking about, you know, seeing that in a different way. I think it's more personal when you're actually making the calls as to whether or not you feel like you lost a sale in comparison to, you know, you get visitors to your website all the time that don't convert and you don't give it a second thought. But one big difference between having people hit a landing page and talking to people is something Mike brought up. You can take notes and get feedback instantly on every person you talk to. And so you can A/B test and change what you're doing with every call. And that doesn't mean that you're going to get your conversion rates, you know, to skyrocket, because you always are still fighting you're still calling someone relatively cold and you may not be hitting them at the right time. But you can do a lot of moving toward how the customers think and what kind of language they use really fast. Where if you even add a survey to a landing page, you know, it really hits your conversion rates a little bit, because you have another call to action on the page, you have more things going on, it detracts from what you want people to do. So I think cold calling can give you a big leg up there, and you can get a lot of feedback really fast.
Right, you get a lot more of the why a lot faster than if you have 1,000 people hit your site. You can tell they're not converting, but you don't know why.
Right.
So that makes sense. Do you have any comments or thoughts on that? I mean, I realize it was kind of a broad question, but it was like, what are the approximate conversion rates given your experience of calling to doing some kind of customer development, calling for an idea? Like, is it 1 in 20 calls someone actually talks to you, or is it more than that?
No, for me, it was a lot higher than that. I usually try to have really targeted lists that I'm going after. I do a lot of different things to target the lists. You know, picking people that are entrepreneurs, making sure that I'm talking to someone who can make something of a purchasing decision, someone that has a stake in whatever it is that I'm trying to do, the problem I'm trying to solve, businesses that are close enough that I could do something face-to-face if that's an option. So all those things, like, just bring you closer to the target, and they realize it kind of instantly as you get them talking. My percentages doing cold calling for customer development are closer to like 25 or 50%, depending on the market and how good I could come up with a targeted list, how targeted the list was, and exactly how sure I was of what the product was to make a difference.
Right. Right. And that makes sense. I mean, you know, Mike was trying to sell something, right? And that people know that when you call, whereas you, if I recall, had a good opener where it was like, I'm a local entrepreneur and I'm thinking about building some software. Could you help? I mean, it wasn't like I'm selling you something, right? It's a totally different opening.
Yeah. Well, actually, the opening that was the most successful, I wrote a blog post about, you know, 100% conversion rate. And that was true. That happened for several weeks for me where I was calling people and I was basically pitching to say, hey, I'm going to come out to your facility, do a tour, take some pictures, talk to you about how you handle, you know, X, Y, and Z. It was people that bred white-tailed deer, like on a kind of a farm setup. And every one of them was like totally into me coming out and doing that. I mean, it was free publicity for them. None of them knew a lot about online marketing, but they were all excited about having more of it done for them.
Right, because you were going to interview them and do like a little bit of a case study or talk about their thing and publish it on your blog.
I had a blog that was, you know, inside of the whitetail management niche. And so, yeah, it was really a win for everybody. And that was what got me, you know, super high conversion rates. But I've also done calls where I don't really have a value pitch. I'm just kind of trading on, you know, people's willingness to help out someone getting things started. And even then, the conversion rates are a lot higher. My brother-in-law is in heavy equipment sales and rental. And I have a good friend that did like door-to-door and commercial security system sales. And they have times where, you know, they have to go into the office and make 100 or 200 calls a day. And I know their conversion rates are closer to what Mike said, closer to, you know, maybe 5%. And a lot of times, especially in the like the residential security system space, the 5% is he gets to convert 5% to let him show up and do a presentation. Those aren't sales.
Yep. It's next steps.
I know some people who work in the high-tech sales area for, you know, basically doing cold calling for enterprise sales, and they routinely make at least 50 to 60 calls a day, and they might get two or three a week that they have to, or that they are able to basically hand over to sales reps to go after for the next step. I mean, it's not unusual to make that many calls in a day and have to continue making that many calls and just not get very many that they're able to turn over. In the past couple of weeks, I've been doing cold calling or warm calling for Audit Shark. And, you know, as Robert said, I mean, the conversion rate on that type of question or that type of call is significantly higher. I mean, I haven't had anybody in the past two or three weeks that I've tried to talk to say, no, I don't have time. I don't want to talk to you.
Right. And I think we should be clear here. The reason we're talking about cold calling again is it obviously has a place in customer development, a place before you have a product. It is going to be super helpful for touching base with people who aren't necessarily online. And there are huge amounts of niches that are not online. And even if they are online, there's still a way to get, it's a way to get better feedback, to iterate quicker. There's some value there. I don't think any of us are espousing, you know, leaving online marketing behind and going out and just, you know, having me stop my SEO on Hittail and just cold calling 100 times a day. You know, that doesn't make sense. We have these online marketing skills for a reason, so that we can bring a lot of people to our sites and convert them. But this is just one, it's kind of like one more approach that you can try out. And it's obviously especially good for some very specific instances. And I think I haven't done outbound cold calling. I have done some very specific emails to some companies that I know could really use some of my products. And it's not like I get this list, I buy a list. It's nothing like that. It's like I will pick out a single person and hand send them an email and be like, hey, it's almost like you could call it a cold email, but of course, unsolicited cold email is spam in the US. But it's like a personal note from me, and it's commenting on how, you know, I think that this product could help them. And so I can totally see the value of this outbound approach, which is what cold calling and cold emailing, you know, postcards and all that kind of stuff really is more of an outbound approach than we often talk about. But there's definitely some value there. It opens up a new market. So Robert, earlier you mentioned that your conversion rate often depended on how well you were able to generate a list, like to get the call list. If I were to generate a call list, I would go to Google and search for companies, or I would have my VA do it, and then I would just you know, put it in a spreadsheet and kind of order it by some criteria. Is that how you did it, or do you have other recommendations?
Yeah, so I had a professor in college that used to always say that the answer is it depends. Especially when you ask marketing questions, the answer is pretty much always it depends. But that is usually a good approach to start with. There are some other places to get information about industries. It depends on, you know, what kind of industry you're going after. If you're going after some of the older, more established industries, there are usually associations, state registries, big companies that basically just sell lists, like a Hoover's, or there's half a dozen others that are pretty good sources of information, and most of which you can get for free in different ways. And starting with Googling is a pretty good way to start. It's especially effective if you use a VA, but you have to be a little bit careful. It depends on the types of calls you want to make and the volume of calls you want to make. I think that's a great way to get 30 or 40 people to talk to, but if you were really going to call 200 or sustain calling 20 or 30 a week or something, then it's going to break down fairly quickly.
Right, you're just going to run out of prospects. So if I, let's say there's someone's listening to this and they want to, they're thinking about writing software for electrical contractors to help them with some part of their business. And they're thinking, obviously they're not exactly the target online audience that they can really drive them to a landing page and get emails. How many people do you think, if they put together a list from Google of 40 or 50 local electrical contractors, do you think that's enough if they called all of them to vet this idea or not, to kind of have an idea of whether their software idea has legs?
Yeah, in my experience, that's enough people to talk to. I think if you can actually talk to 20 or 25 people, you get a fairly clear idea. Some people will quote higher numbers. Some people will quote lower numbers. Some people will change it up and say, you need 5 sales or 10 sales. The best advice I got on that front was Jason Cohen picked up a tweet of mine asking a similar question a while back, and he said, you can stop whenever you don't learn anything anymore. And so from that perspective, you really want just to find the place where, okay, I've called 20 or I've called 30 or 40, and I'm not really getting new things from what these people are saying. Either there's not something I can solve here, there's not something consistent, or wow, a lot of these people would pay for this.
Got it. And do you, here's the big question, and I know the answer is it depends, but I'm wondering, do you mention price?
You may or may not mention price in your initial call. Sometimes I use calls, especially with local people, and in the early stages, as a way to set up a face-to-face, but you definitely mention price at some point in the process. It's got to be part of you deciding if this is a viable business or not. Because it doesn't matter if you have something for electrical contractors that all of them want to buy, but all of them want to buy it for $9 a month, and you need it to be $50 a month, then you still have nothing.
Right. All right. Well, Robert, I appreciate you coming on the show. Your ebook, which is at coldcallingbook.net, is, I know it has other stuff. It talks about writing a script, the importance of taking notes, dealing with gatekeepers, and I think you have an appendix with sample notes that you took and sample scripts and all that stuff. If someone was interested in finding out more and going deeper into this topic, they can go to coldcallingbook.net. But if they want to catch up with you, I know you have a blog where you talk about this kind of stuff, as well as process of getting your own startup off the ground. Where would they find you?
The best place is whitetailsoftware.com. That's the blog.
Very cool. Well, thanks again for coming on the show, and we'll see you at MicroConf 2013.
Thanks a lot, guys.
If you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or as Mike would say, 9960, because Mike transposed the numbers last week. Or you can email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
You know it's not funny when you have to explain the joke.